Hi, everyone. Well, welcome back to this occasional series of podcasts with me having a blether with a good Mindstorm member. And I mean a good Mindstorm member, but there's someone who, you know, has come to lots of courses over the years, but more importantly, has brought family, friends, colleagues, or introduced me to their companies and so on. People have really taken it to their life. It's become part of their life, if you like, a way of life, and it's had a big impact. And so today I've got a really special guest because not only is Jonathan a fantastic Mindstorm member from my point of view, but him and I have got a very special thing in common, which is way different from any other relationship I may have with any other Mindstorm member, and we'll maybe get to that later on. However, I can say that one of the reasons why I would say Jonathan is one of the great Mindstorm members is because, you know, he's the kind of guy that shows up, you know, especially when I'm doing something new. And when you're doing something new with Mindstorm, until you test it out, you never really know. And guys like Jonathan, people like him show up and they're in the audience and you know very quickly just by their smile or the non-verbal communication that something's happening that's worth them listening to and giving up their time. And I've got tremendous respect for him. But anyway, enough of that. Jonathan Horrocks, welcome to the podcast. It's a real pleasure to have you here and thanks for giving up your time.
Well, thanks very much, Jack. It's a great pleasure. In fact, a great honour that you've asked me.
That's very kind of you. Jonathan, now, obviously, what we tend to do here is start with the person's credentials, their Mindstorm credentials, of which you've got more than a few. Perhaps you could just fill people in on, you know, when you first got involved with us, where that was, what kind of courses you've done and so on. That would be quite an interesting way to begin.
Absolutely. Well, I very first came to Mindstorm for Business almost 30 years ago.
Wow.
And I remember to this day the piece of advertising material, the leaflet that you sent out to people at that time.
Yeah.
And it arrived when I'd just come back from a couple of weeks' holiday, which is an absolutely fantastic holiday. And I was back in the office feeling a bit fed up, not really wanting to be there. And in my holiday post that was there waiting for me was your leaflet. And it went something along the lines of, are you feeling fed up? Need a bit of inspiration? Then you need a dose of Jack Black. And I signed up instantly. And what's better, got my company to pay for it because it just hit me right between the eyes. I was definitely looking for inspiration. And that was a start of a long journey. Almost 30 years ago, and wow. And here we are now, 30 years later, talking.
Yeah, amazing, really. But you have done quite a lot of the courses, haven't you?
I have. Yep, I went to the next step a few years later. I also brought my wife to Mindstorm for Life a year or so after the Mindstorm for Business. I've been to the Best of Mindstorm, and Whispering with Giants. And it's always been fantastic to have a top-up from time to time. Because I find, and it's something I've also discussed with other Mindstorm members, is that from time to time you fall off the Mindstorm wagon.
Yeah.
And what we've always found is that our lives don't go so well when that happens.
Yeah.
So when you get a bit of a new inspiration and get back on, then life and everything just goes that much better.
Yeah. I've always known when I was teaching, especially away at the beginning, and you came at the beginning, when there might be four-day courses then, over two weekends or over two midweek days. And there was a lot of material there, a tremendous amount of material. Even when we cut it to 2 days, there was still a lot of stuff going on in those courses. And I did encourage people to repeat. And I think some people kind of thought, well, surely you just have to attend the course once. But in fact, with Mindstorm, it seems to be the case that you've got to repeat it as often as you can, and that's why we always made it easy for people to do that. But and so you not only would you get the opportunity to mix with like-minded people, and I always felt that when repeaters came, they added real value to the newcomers. And you must have enjoyed that, coming so often, just to be there with Mindstorm members around and but also the new people. You can say a bit about that.
Well, definitely. I mean, I've always loved to share things that I've found myself have made a positive impact in my life, and Mindstorm has certainly done that. Because one of the things that you always encouraged us to do was to read more deeply into the subject,
yeah.
And you recommended all sorts of books and other aspects of personal development, and so I read books and also went to other courses and listened to other personal development gurus, if you pardon that expression, one of whom, for example, was Tony Robbins.
Of course.
And clearly he's very, very big in that field.
Yeah.
But what I always felt about Tony was that on the Monday morning at the end of the course, you know, once it was over, Tony wasn't there anymore. And the energy and the inspiration that he put in over the weekend, he wasn't there anymore.
Yeah.
And without that, there was something missing.
Yeah.
And inevitably what that meant was you had to sign up for another multi-thousand pound course to get that inspiration again and plug into Tony.
Yeah.
The thing I always found so special about your courses, Jack, was that you made them extremely affordable for everybody. And at the end of the weekend, you'd given us tools and techniques that we could go away with and plug into those tools and techniques. And in fact, you're encouraging us not to be reliant on you, but to be reliant on those tools and techniques that we would practice.
Yeah.
And after, you know, 30 years on and, you know, on and off over the years, as you mentioned, I keep on coming back to Jack Black and Mindstore because there's something consistent and solid about that. And the techniques work. And I always felt that Tony didn't give you techniques. You had to have a piece of him.
Yeah. Well, I'm very, very grateful, excuse me, for that feedback. And we at the beginning, I faced this big decision, and there wasn't the internet back then, and there wasn't as many people that I could share what I was doing with, because I was right at the beginning, no clients, no friends that understood what I was doing. I was really much on my own. And the whole thing was, do you, because obviously I found over the years I can hold an audience. I could have polished up my audience holding skills. I could have done some stuff up and down the stage. Or do I share techniques? And the techniques initially back then weren't so sexy because it meant getting an audience, first of all, to trust you. It would take up to maybe 2 o'clock in the afternoon of the first day to actually close their eyes. And that seems ridiculous now to most people listening to this. But way back when I started, people were genuinely terrified. They thought that maybe you were brainwashing them or maybe you were hypnotizing them into some state they couldn't control. And so they would very, very reluctant close their eyes. And I had to overcome that and work with that. But that was where the secret was. That's where the key was. You know, it wasn't so much, and I respect Tony. Obviously, when he came to the UK the first time, I took 750 people to see him, all Mindstore members. You know, I was recommending his books and so on forever. And, you know, I understand the passion of being in the moment with him. It's awesome. And I was with him in Dublin just a couple of years back. And the same thing, you know, we all go there, we all get hyped up, we're all dancing about, and it's just wonderful. But as I found, you know, 20-odd years on from the first time, well, you know, I can remember the firewalk, and it was amazing, but I don't remember any technique. I remember something happened to a lady on the stage, but that was about it. Whereas I knew that if I stuck with the techniques and tools and techniques, people wouldn't need me. It'd be nice to get them back to repeat for all sorts of good reasons, but nevertheless, it should be able to stand on its own, and I'm really grateful for you sharing that, because so many people come back and say, you know, I still remember the house with the red roof. I remember all the rooms, how to use those screens. And I'm ever so grateful. So that's really encouraging. Is there any particular tool or technique that you find you tend to use more than another, or do you just generally dig in and out?
It's in particular the programming room, you know, with the four screens.
Yes, yes.
That's the one. From time to time, I remember that there are other rooms that I probably could have used better and should have more.
Yep.
But it's particularly the programming room that that I like most.
And have you found that when I introduced about 10 years ago now, I introduced that fourth screen. Did that make sense to you? Do you find that helpful?
I do. It's one of those areas where I probably could need to do more work on that.
Yeah.
And feel the impact of the effect you're having on people.
Yes.
But you know, part of your philosophy has always been about integrity.
Yes.
And obviously the impact that you have on both yourself and on other people is incredibly important.
Yeah.
And that has to be done with integrity.
Yeah. And what about the other thing? I think, you know, people like you who are long standing, Mindstorm members, as I like to call you guys, folks. You know, it's did you use the whole thing about the inner coaches? You know, the conversations, the whispers, if you like. Have you used that much?
I definitely had, and I think perhaps on a previous occasion I mentioned that I was involved in a court case a few years ago.
Yes.
And I believe that I won that court case from my bed.
Wow.
And that sounds a bit weird, but no. What I mean is that I did my programming when I was in the alpha state first thing in the morning.
Yeah.
And had imaginary conversations with both the people of my own team,
yeah,
but also with the opposition.
Yes.
And I had these conversations persuading the opposition that they were doing the wrong thing and they might as well stop, give up, and settle with me.
Yes.
And the court, and that the case went my way.
It's fantastic, yeah. It's especially, you know, I find it too. I mean, you know, I was also on the court case with people wanting to steal their database and so on, and that was a year and a half thing, but that was a constant good in there in programming too, and the conversations, the inner conversations, were so important. We ended up kind of winning, as it were, but it certainly without it, I don't know what would have happened. So presumably you got a confidence in going deep and just quietly listening through that tool. Any particular coach you might care to mention that you worked with?
The coaches I had were more sort of personal people.
Oh, I
see. Because one of my my friends and coaches at the time was the Attorney General at the time.
Perfect.
and I thought that was quite a useful member to my legal team, and in addition, someone I wasn't having to pay.
But it certainly gave you confidence to make the right decisions at the right time. Yeah.
It gave me enormous confidence because, as you'd appreciate, litigation, you know, is quite a stressful thing, and even if you are right and you believe that everything should go your way, sometimes, you know, litigation is a bit haphazard.
Yeah.
And for reasons you can't understand, sometimes it can go the wrong way. Yeah. And it's risky. And it gave me enormous confidence that I was doing the right thing, that I should pursue it, and that I was in the right, and that the opposition genuinely should feel that they should give up.
Yeah.
And that confidence saw me through to the point that I persevered and was able to win.
Wow. But also, times of adversity is when Mindstorm can be really, really special. And often I look out at an audience when we begin, and most of them are there, one would imagine, to improve their life. There's maybe something they're doing or beginning, and they want to make sure they make it work, or they've come along to set the goals and all that stuff. But inevitably, there are people in the audience who, perhaps days later, the next day, weeks later, months later, may find themselves facing adversity. And that's when the tools, like you've just explained, they can become really, really special. We dig deep, we find the stuff there that's in us to fight on and continue on when life can get tough. But then when it is wonderful, it truly is wonderful. And one of the things that I admire about you is that you've shown up not only with your wonderful wife, but your kids, yeah? And that's always encouraging, that a parent wants to share this with the family.
Well, that was always something that was very important to me, because at an early stage, I felt that Mindstorm was of great benefit to me, not only in terms of general programming goals,
yeah,
and just thinking about goals in the first place and having them written down,
yeah,
but also thinking, you know, thinking positively and always having a positive angle on whenever anything happened,
yeah,
and believing that in you know, karma, that what goes around comes around,
yeah,
and if you keep on believing, eventually, you know, things will turn your way,
yeah,
and things happen for a reason, and if things don't go perfectly your way, then there's something better that around the corner that you haven't thought of. Or the timing perhaps isn't quite right for the best solution.
Yeah. And that's been your general experience. You know, after all these years, you must be very, very aware of that.
Absolutely. And it's because of this way of thinking, about thinking, because before I came to Mindstorm, I'd probably have described myself as a pessimist.
Yes.
Mindstorm was one of the things that helped me to become much, much more optimistic.
Yes. And that opening up to optimism, the positive attitude, the solution orientation, has taken you from the job you were doing when you first came along. You know, your employer, you know, paid for you, invested in you, and yet you found your way through all of this growth that was going on at the time with Mindstone and reading the books and doing the other courses and stuff. You've moved on and had quite an interesting career, have you not?
That's right. I mean, I haven't been in the office. I mean, I'm only 61 now, but I haven't been in the office since I was 55.
Wow.
And I retired young.
Yes.
And this was something that I've been programming for some years for a change of career.
Yeah.
Because although my career in the financial industry paid the bills and was a reasonable salary, it wasn't where my heart really was.
Yes.
And I was looking for an opportunity to get involved with investing, which is something I'd had an idea about, but wasn't able to do in my career because of it was too much of a diversion from what I'd been doing.
Yeah.
And I wanted more freedom. You know, that it was the dream. You know, freedom of time, freedom of place, to be able to travel, and that just seemed it was a dream. And as it always preached, you know, you have to keep dreaming. And that dream was to have that level of freedom, which I achieved a bit sooner than I expected at the age of 55.
Wow.
The one strange thing is that, you know, as you mentioned before, it arose initially out of adversity.
Yes.
And something that you'll recognize from your own life experiences, and perhaps what got you into my stuff first, was I went through a period at work with enormous stress.
Yeah.
This caused extreme illness. I ended up in hospital.
Wow.
And I was off work for many, many months. But it was ultimately, as a result of all that, that I was able to effectively retire at the age of 55 and now live the most amazing life where I'm able to travel on a regular basis. For people that read my Facebook post, they think I'm never at home.
That's what I think.
Although that's not entirely true.
No.
I spend all my time doing what I love. And it also gives me the freedom to support my children. So I've been able to visit universities with them and take time off to visit them when they're there, and help with them learning to drive and all sorts of things. So I'm able to put time into those things that I really value now.
Fantastic, fantastic. And, you know, there'll be a lot of people listening, you know, and we've all got our own journeys, with or without Mindstore being by our side all the time. But nevertheless, the thing that's really exciting about having these tools is being able to turn to them and take advantage of the opportunities they throw up. And I mean, have you any advice about, you know, there you are, you're now in this post, you know, office life, you're what people call retired, although you look fairly busy to me, but you're busy doing lots of things that seem like fun. Any advice to anybody who's kind of like, you know, thinking about going for it, especially maybe, you know, in the later on in their lives? There's a whole lot of dynamic around ageism still in our culture. It's maybe getting better. But so there you are. You leave at 55 and you go into a whole new world. Any advice to people maybe thinking about making a leap?
Well, certainly I recommend that people don't make that leap initially without having established a bit of a track record in the new lifestyle.
Yeah.
But a lot of it comes down to building that desire for change.
Yeah.
You've always talked in your programs about having desire, belief and expectation.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it all starts with that strong desire.
Yeah.
And I had that strong desire from commuting into work day after day and just finding it was wearing me down. And eventually it resulted in major health challenges.
Yes.
And so not only does one need to use some Mindstore techniques to while away the stress, and that was one of the times where I wasn't using the techniques properly and managing my stress. So managing your stress is a particularly important thing. But you just keep that level of desire. If you want to looking for a strong change, then that change will happen when you really start to desire it such that it's the only thing that can possibly happen in your life.
Yeah.
You really do everything you can to move towards it. and you start programming day in, day out, writing down your goals and reviewing your goals, particularly using the when using MindStalk techniques in the alpha state.
Yeah. And the thing I think is really, really wonderful, and in fact, this morning on Facebook and LinkedIn and stuff, I posted something about life's purpose and the fact that when we set goals, we snap the chains of inertia kind of thing, we get some momentum. And very often, only once that you're proving to yourself or your higher intelligence or whatever anyone wants to believe, that you're actually acting out this process and you're taking the decisions and you're working through and overcoming the challenges, that somehow or other, a different part of you, a deeper intelligence, a higher intelligence, whatever it's going to be, kind of draws your attention to an entirely different way to go, a different route, a different goal. And because you've got momentum, it's fairly easy to change direction. And essentially, you must have done that at least once and maybe a number of times. Anything about that?
Well, again, I think that one of the things that I've always found particularly helpful about MindStalk techniques is I always felt that it gave me hope.
Yeah.
Because I've built up faith over the years in the techniques working.
Yes.
And if things, reached a certain level of adversity or where things weren't quite going the way I wanted, sometimes that was a reminder call to get back to using the techniques to their fullest.
Yeah.
And I always had this belief thing that, perhaps things aren't working as well because I'm not using my MindStalk techniques properly.
Yeah.
Now, once I start using those, things will get better.
Yeah.
And that it always gave me that feeling of hope.
Yeah.
Because I built the confidence that they work.
Yeah. I suppose it's almost like a sports person, if they're fit, they've trained well, and opportunities come along during the match, they're able to take advantage of them. On the other hand, if they're not fit, they've not been training well, opportunities come along, they can't quite seize them. And it's something about that. It's about being in the groove, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I think also combining the programming with affirmations, particularly, building that image of being a champion or being someone who's going to succeed with whatever they want to achieve.
Yeah.
And of course, we very recently had the Winter Olympics.
Yep.
And I was listening very carefully to the language of some of these sports people.
Yes.
And some of them were not talking like champions.
No.
They had lost before they went into the game. Whereas others, had such enormous confidence. And you could see, they had the image of being a champion.
Yeah. It's very interesting you mentioned that. It's something I'm increasingly concerned about. When I watch my own favourite football team, have opportunities that they so often lose out on. And you can see quite clearly there's a lack of confidence. There's a fear thing that seems to hit someone, especially there's quite a young football team. But one of the things that, when I was doing the sport thing way, way early on, of course, I'm coming from a very right-brained position into this. And long before sports psychology was really, really respected, I'm pushing away there, been identified as one when I wasn't, and yet I now see the left-brained sports psychology really, really at the fore, and really not still yet dealing with this softer stuff that's so critically important. So yeah, we've got sports people who are got all the left-brained sports science they could ever muster, and yet the bit that really matters, they're not quite getting at, and it's a real shame. But I think that's inevitable. You let the, with respect to them, you sometimes let the scientists close to things, and they start confusing it all.
Well, one of the particular examples I thought of recently was when Leicester City won the Premiership.
Yes, indeed,
amazing. And nobody, including themselves, could believe that they'd done it.
No,
but they didn't do the programming in the mind to create that image of themselves as champions, because when the next season came around, they disappeared. They were no longer at the top.
But they also demonstrated, again, I found it in sport all the time, was the power of the comfort zone. They were way out their comfort zone for a season. They win the thing, and then you could put your money on it, they would disappear the next season.
Yeah, exactly.
Unless you're true champions, then you've got to reset. As soon as you achieve the goal, it's almost an anticlimax. Let's set the next one. And the next one would have been, let's win the Champions League or something. But they probably just went into that tournament, like a lot of people in the Olympics there, just to participate, sadly.
Whereas an opposite to that is someone like Roger Federer,
yes,
who's got such an image for himself as the champion.
Absolutely.
Here he is, years older than he should be a champion,
yeah,
still coming back and winning these tournaments time after time.
Yeah.
What a hero he is.
Yeah, and this conversation, for them, if I just remembered the one thing I really, really did learn from, apart from the firewalk thing, from Tony Robbins, was in that first event he did in the NEC in Birmingham, 750, I think someone was alongside me kind of thing. It was really cool, 3,000 in the audience. He got us in after lunch one day and we played this game where he said, let's play Simon Says. And at the end of it, you know, there'll be a winner and they'll get a prize. And the whole thing was Simon Says stand up. So we all stand up, you know, Simon Says sit down, stand up, you know, raise your left arm and all that. And eventually he got us to do something without saying Simon Says. And half the audience, including myself, were to sit down because we were out. And we played the whole game until he got round to about 10 people, got them up in the stage, continued till he got down to 6, then he got 4, then 3, then 2, then somebody won. And then he sort of found in the audience who was the eighth last person. And we found who it was, and he got a microphone to them and asked them, what were you thinking about before we started the game? And the person said they were thinking about winning. He then found the person that was ninth, and they admitted they were just thinking about playing. And he then asked the audience, you know, of all of you, how many of you started out with the view that you would win? And it was only the 6 people plus the guy that was 8th, the 7th guy, somehow or other, got lost in it, that actually started out with a view of winning and were still there at the end.
Wow.
And what I took out of that, and I'm sure everybody else did, was that in any competition, going for the interview, you know, all that stuff, when a competition is there and we're in a competitive world, very, very few people in the competition believe they can win. And the ones that tend to believe they can are the ones that consistently do win.
And they will exude confidence.
Exactly. And often just their presence, that thing we can't put a finger on, but we can somehow or other, I like to use the word, you know, smell it, we feel it, we know it, we can't measure it. It's totally right brain stuff. But, you know, it's there. There's some recognition in our being that when you come up against these people, you just know they're going to beat you, and you just know that they're better than you. And they have this aura, whereas most people's aura is one of just participation.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's awesome. So that, again, just by as soon as we go into the competitive world and we're already pre-programmed and we're using all our tools and techniques, we've got such an edge on everyone else, you know. But the great thing about us, because of the 4 screen you've alluded to, we not only want to win for ourselves, but we know that if we win, others benefit too.
Definitely.
So, Jonathan, let's move on a wee bit. You've had a great journey. You love travelling, and so you know, you and I, you know, we you come to courses. I get kind of used to seeing you from time to time. I really make a connection to you. I don't know why I'm making the connection, other than you're just a good guy in the audience and always come out and say hello. And then lo and behold, one of the things I did with Mainster was I wanted to prove to people that the tools worked. And so I was at a standing start, not a lot of, you know, in debt, borrowed money off a shark who loaned money out to actually get the thing up and running, paid him off at exorbitant rates because the bank wouldn't support me. Nobody could see what I was doing. And kept going. Then I would program, like, let's get a new house, program the house, get a better house, program a car, get a better car. Eventually I was programming things that were just, you know, things that just didn't fit into my life experience, like let's program to have a yacht or a boat and all these things, and I got all of those. Then eventually, to test it out, I thought, let's program and get that castle, buy that castle that I used to see when I was a student every day, that I dreamt about when I would go driving past, especially lit up in the winter nights with the floodlights. Lo and behold, I achieved that as well. And what I was doing there wasn't so much to win all these things, have all these things. It was to prove to people that this stuff works. But the thing was, when I got that castle, when we moved into it, and I think I shared that with some people in the audience, there you were. And lo and behold, you had a connection. Now, what is that connection?
Well, one of the things that I was aware of when we very first met was that at the time you lived up in Strathblane,
Yes.
and we were talking about living up there, and you used to say that you took a particular sort of shortcut
Yes.
which went past through the village of Balderneck,
Yeah.
where my grandparents and great grandparents were buried.
Yes.
So I immediately had a sort of degree of connection because you were passing by and able to say hello to my ancestors.
Yes.
And subsequently, my father and mother are buried in that graveyard now.
Beautiful place.
And so I was very aware that that you lived in that part of the world where my family used to live. But when you told me that you'd bought Bardwy Castle, I was pretty amazed because my grandmother was brought up there. My great grandfather, James Scott Anderson, owned that castle for many years.
Awesome.
And there it was, you'd bought it too.
Yeah, that was just so unbelievable when you shared that with me.
That is the most incredible coincidence of all
Yeah.
time.
Yeah.
But the thing that was particularly special for me too was that a couple of years after you bought the castle, you very kindly invited me to come over to see it because
Yeah.
I'd driven past it many times and
Yeah.
loved it and thought about the times when my family had owned it and lived there. But this was the first opportunity for me to see it and look around, and that was a very special experience for me, for which I'm very grateful.
Well, I think more grateful than you because to have that connection, because not everybody's going to buy a castle, I suppose, but when you buy one, you're very, very aware of just how insignificant you really are in the scheme of things, especially when it goes way back. In some cases, they believe maybe to as far back as the 13th century, and possibly before then. But you're only really sort of looking after it while you have it in your hands. But to have that connect, especially, I mean, what was the chance of you showing up at a course in London all these years later? Not only doing this podcast, but I actually buy the house of your ancestors.
Well, it's hard to imagine, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's one of the beautiful things about being in tune with this stuff. Mind store, there's these connections that if you can follow them, then you find magic takes place. There's definitely, it's that thing about, you say to people, if you hear or see someone three times, or something comes in three times, and maybe the big man, if there is a big man, is shouting down at you to pay attention.
But also in my family, there's another interesting coincidence through
Yes.
the same family,
Yep.
in that my great grandfather, James Scott Anson, he after I think he owned Bardwy Castle for about 20 years or so
Yes.
whilst my grandmother was growing up, but then moved to buy a different castle overlooking Loch Lomond.
Wow.
That's the loch he was overlooking wasn't big enough in Bardwy, so he
Yes, 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 yes.
wanted to choose
Yes,
the
yes.
biggest of them all,
Yes, of
and it
course.
had a fantastic view. But what we also discovered about this castle, Tylachun Castle, that he bought, was that both my mother's family and my father's family both owned that castle at one time.
Amazing.
And in fact, there was only one owner that wasn't a member of my family in between the two of them.
That's
And
fantastic. And there was a story about that during the war, is there not?
that's right. Yeah, my mother had always told me that the castle had been used as a headquarters for testing torpedoes in Loch Lomond during the war,
Wow.
because the factory where they made the torpedoes had been making Argyle cars up to the war. And then, in common with so many factories, they were turned over to munitions and war efforts. And this was the story that we'd always heard. But when I did some research more recently, I discovered that this castle had also then been converted to being a base for training people, Wrens, members of the Women's Royal Naval Service, for code breaking.
Wow.
And they then, many of them, then went on to Bletchley Park, where they were breaking the Enigma code.
Amazing.
And we only discovered this in the last 10 years or so, because up to that, it had been kept secret for 50 years. So that my great grandfather's house had been, I don't know, a secret part of the war.
Wow. Absolutely fantastic. One of the stories I don't often get the chance to tell about the castle and myself was that long before the castle came up for sale, you know, and you know, I was still occasionally taking that shortcut past the graveyard on the way past the castle, if I was heading to Edinburgh or whatever. And you know, what I happened to me was, I got it. We had a CEO who came and worked for Mindstore for a while, and his wife was heavily involved with BAFTA. She was one of the key directors in the BAFTA organisation. And through her and him, I got invited to the premiere of Rob Roy McGregor, the movie, Rob Roy. Oh, yes. And that was very special. And then later, Braveheart as well, which is another story, a wonderful story, and yet another castle connection, because it was actually in Stirling Castle, the premiere, but there you go. And when I was when I went to see the movie, I was inspired by it. I really enjoyed the movie. It was something special about it. So I then went ahead and got a copy of one of the books on Rob Roy. It wasn't, Sir Walter Scott, forgive me, yeah. It wasn't Sir Walter Scott's famous book. It was a different book, and it was more about his life story. And I read that book, and I just really enjoyed it. And something happened one night where I found myself not sleeping, couldn't quite get back to sleep, and I thought, fair enough, let's get up. I want to finish this book, and I headed downstairs. And this is when I was living in Strathblane. And so I go downstairs, I sit down, favourite chair, and I start reading the book to complete it. And I get to the point in the book where Rob Roy dies. And something bizarre happens. I started to weep. As if I was connected to him. It was really strange. You know, it was like hearing a close family member had died or passed on, and suddenly a shock and grief. And that was bizarre. I mean, I was like, what is happening here? I was really quite amazed, but I genuinely felt this tremendous sense of grief. And then to the point where the following weekend on the Sunday, we went away up to Balquhidder to see his grave and all that type of thing. And then months later, I hear of the castle going up for sale, and the programming had been running on and off, and I go for it, and I'm fortunate, and I get the castle. And then there's a whole thing about being up in the ramparts, which I showed you, and I was up there in the ramparts and walking about in the grand hall and stuff, and suddenly I sort of realised, wait a minute, there's a connection here. And the connection was that Rob Roy used to spend lots of time in the castle because his favourite nephew married into a family called the Hamiltons. In fact, his favourite nephew was called Black Knee McGregor. And Black Knee McGregor married into the Hamilton family, and if you like, took over as the owner of the castle. So there you are. All these months later, I own the castle. I'm living in the castle, and Rob Roy McGregor would have been a regular guest.
Wow, that's incredible.
It's just awesome. I mean, I love these connections that you... Then you have to, figure out what's that all about and so on. And that allowed me to learn a lot more about the castle, that I went deeper into stuff to do with it, which we won't talk about now because this goes on and on. But it's certainly fascinating, and it was a privilege to live there for as long as we did.
Well, that's one part of the history that I'd never heard before. So that's really, really interesting.
Yes, indeed. And you can only imagine him travelling back and forward from maybe the north or the east or the west, coming through towards, because he spent a lot of time in Loch Lomond side, funnily enough. So coming through and by, he would stop off there. And one would imagine in some of those, in that grand hall at night time, maybe enjoying a glass of something or whatever it would be, and whiling away his night and enjoying good food.
Yeah, and what a man of influence it was, spending time there.
Yeah, awesome, just awesome. So, Jonathan, what are you up to now? Have you big plans for the future? Are you still taking it easy, or are you, anything bigger? You seem to travel a lot. Any nice place on the horizon?
I recently came back from doing a very unusual trip to the Far East. Went to Singapore and Thailand, and in Singapore went to see a bullion vault.
Oh yes,
and was able to handle a gold bar, 15 kilogram gold bar, which not only was it a bit like going to the gym and far heavier than I'd expected, but I was handling this gold bar worth £500,000.
Wow.
which is extraordinary.
Wow.
But the extraordinary thing was that the vault itself just looked like going to a warehouse with for IKEA or something like that.
Wow.
Just that the difference that instead of being flat pack furniture and groceries and things like that, it was gold and silver bars.
Yes.
But wow. And then went on a gemstone tour, finding out all that how to source gemstones and where they're made and how they go from being simple like rocks and stones in the earth, which you recover largely by doing a more industrial level of what would be most people think of as panning for gold.
Yes.
You just get a whole rock, stick it into a sieve, and then put water through it to get the final rocks. And then at the end of the day, you end up with a few small stones that become gemstones and are potentially highly valuable.
Yeah.
Absolutely fascinating doing that. And there's an opportunity to go and to see that again,
and
find out more about gemstones, which is something very unusual and very special.
Yeah, and that reminds me of another strange story of mine. You know, I open my mind up to all sorts of stuff because I've got this huge open mind about the right brain, and one of the things that happened was fairly early on. I there used to be a lot of really wonderful, I used to term them old hippies, that came, there's a group of them, came to the courses early on, and they were into dowsing and all sorts of stuff. And occasionally I would go along to a meeting, they'd invite me along to something, and there'd be a speaker and, you know, talking about some wonderful sort of right brain type spiritual thing very often as well. And it was always very interesting just to go and hear these people and see what they were up to. They were great mindset people, but nevertheless, they had this wider, you know, thing. They tended to more of the spiritual thing rather than taking off to see robins, you know. But that was fine. And I had a go at this dowsing thing fairly early on, and I found I was very good at it. And I came across an article about gold in the Perthshire Hills, and people were beginning to pan some of the rivers and were getting little nuggets of gold and stuff. And so what I did, I took a very sceptical friend of mine, colleague of mine, and we went to the Mitchell Library in Glasgow and got out some really old maps and found a map of Gold Panning River somewhere up, it was way up in the northeast of Scotland, one of the Cromarty, somewhere, was it Ross and Cromarty, I think that was it, one of those places way north. And there was a river there, and what I did was I sort of got the pendulum thing out I had, and I sort of let it swing around that place in the map. And then what I did was I had a huge big map of Scotland, and I just very carefully went back and forward across the map. It was very, very slow. And what happened was somewhere southeast of Glasgow, I started to get a reaction.
Oh.
And I was like, wow. And then I didn't know at the time, but I marked that on the map and figured out where it was down a road. And about a month later, in the summertime, my friend and I and another guy, we thought, let's go and do a bit of camping overnight, go down to this part of the world and see if we can find some gold. It was really pretty funny. But and to be honest, we had a nice bottle of good malt whiskey, and we were going to light a fire and cook some food and just have a kind of boys' night kind of thing. But we did. We down and started doing some dowsing and stuff. And then we found out someone came to speak to us, the landowner, whatever. We hadn't asked permission, but because we just thought we'd go for it. There seemed to be quite, you know, rights of way type tracks were in fields, but. And anyway, long story short, we were on a piece of land which is famous for, in the past, gold being found. And that blew me away with the power of using, you know, dowsing or whatever. And one of the great stories early on in my career was, many of you know, I used to work with old Jose Silva before he advised me to leave and go and do my own thing, which I'm ever so grateful for. Gave me my blessing and blessed the course. You know, he looked at it and said, you're okay, on you go. That was the House of the Red Roof course, and one of the things that he talked about was his conversations with Uri Geller, and how Uri Geller was able to use dowsing to find gold and other gems and in fact, precious metals and even oil. And one of the stories that goes about him is that he's got the Mexican government gave him a passport with a number one on it. Because he found oil for the Mexican government just by dowsing.
Goodness me.
And later on I met him in London at a gig I was doing with him for a company. The two of us were working together and it was pretty amazing just to watch him working with all that type of stuff. So yeah, so there's more to this world than meets the eye, that's for certain.
Definitely, yeah.
Yeah, I could go on forever, the stories. And anywhere particularly you are travelling soon, Jonathan?
Well, one of the places I want to go to fairly soon is Klaus's clinic in Stuttgart.
Of course,
I'd like to spend some time there.
Yes.
Because you know, one of the other connections for me and one that I'm extremely grateful for is that you introduced me to Klaus, who does a mine store in Germany.
Yeah.
But he also, together with his friend Lothar, set up this non-toxic clinic in Germany.
Yeah.
You know, perhaps you'd like to say a few words about that, how that came about.
And, yes, I'm really grateful for you mentioning that other connection you and I have is the great friendship and love we have for Klaus and Lothar and the clinic, because you know, I from an early standpoint of doing this work, I was very interested in healing. I've always have been, and I've you know, played around a wee bit with that as well early on. And we still do some distance healing to this day. Quite a lot of Mindstone members are that way inclined. And so I've always been open-minded to alternatives. And to this day, they fascinate me and they drive me. And so when I bumped into Klaus, Klaus came to do a London course, maybe around about the same time as you, many, many moons ago. Mindstone for Business, and he asked me about getting involved with could he take it to Germany? He was working in London then, he was a merchant banker, and his wife was working for a big shoe company, marketing person, and together they went back to Germany, they took Mindstone there, and that's the reason they went back, and they opened Mindstone and started working, and out of that he re-established a great friendship with Lothar. Lothar had witnessed the terrible and sad death of a very close friend from cancer, and he resolved to spend the rest of his life doing what he could to help find a solution to this terrible, terrible disease. And he found himself very quickly moving away from the traditional ways of dealing with it, the conventional ways, and found himself into the alternative world. And out of that, he met the great Joanna Budvig. Joanna Budvig took him under her wing and he started working. Then Klaus got involved with Budvig. Budvig actually said to Klaus that Mindstore, what we were doing with Mindstore was what was a part of what she was needing to add to her regime. And,
wow.
And out of that, then later on, Lothar and Klaus get the extraordinary opportunity. You know, they like we know, and all the Mindstore members who do know, once you start programming, magic happens. And lo and behold, they before they know where they are, they've built a centre, 20-bedded centre where to this day people can go there with cancer, go through a four-week programme, previously a five-week programme, and come out of there. And one of the great things about it, and I was there back in October the year before last, and it was extraordinary just to be with these amazing people. I mean, I've had the privilege of working with huge names, big success, and Olympic athletes. And you look at them sometimes, you walk into a room to meet them for the first time, you're kind of in awe of them because they're big names. But, you know, these people are not giants. The real giants are the men and women who go and tackle something like cancer, life-threatening cancer.
Incredible,
and
yeah.
And they're turning away from the traditional and what the establishment wants them to do. And they go and do something completely in faith with their own, some deep place in their being, knowing this is what they have to do. They then work in tandem with those amazing people that Klaus manages and contributes to the program himself in Stuttgart. And what's amazing is to see how they go in, they get the blood test as they go in, then they come out and they've changed. And I had the privilege of being, I did 3 weeks and I was between two groups. I just went for the rest and recuperation and just to get focused and all that and really enjoy it as a holiday, and it's the best holiday you can ever have. But was to see, you know, a group at the end and see the photographs the day they arrived, and now the photographers are leaving, and it's just an entirely different group of people. And I just love it. I love what they're doing. It's wonderful, and the world should know about it, but the world doesn't necessarily want to hear about it. Even people who might be listening to this right now, it might, I know from experience, it can annoy people because they've lost a loved one, someone they really care for, to cancer, and here's me, here's you, Klaus or Lothar for that matter, saying, look, there are credible alternatives that actually work.
Yeah, well, there does seem to be huge resistance to change, but that's the same in life generally, isn't it, Jack?
It is. And as you know, I'm now very passionate about combining what Stuttgart's all about with the sort of new lifestyle I'm following, because it's getting extraordinary, really extraordinary results too. And when you begin to combine these two approaches, my goodness, it's in your face. There's lots and lots of people, millions and millions of people's lives can be saved.
Well, one of the things I find so incredible about the Budvig system is that the basic component of the oil protein diet is that it's perhaps some no medical claims here, of course, one of the most powerful treatments for cancer.
Yeah.
In my opinion, at least.
No, it is. There's no doubt about it.
And it's the sort of thing that, you know, as my wife and I do, we regularly have it for breakfast.
Yep.
And it's breakfast, but it's also has this incredibly powerful healing effect.
Of course. I mean, it's not the great thing about it. And Lothar, I think sometimes he may have sometimes wishes maybe that he had not only talked about it in terms of cancer, because we know that it has a huge impact, multiple sclerosis, it's lots of degenerative diseases, amazing with heart disease.
Yeah.
Just because all the noise, diabetes. And funnily enough, you know, this stuff I'm on, this low carb, high fat, moderate protein lifestyle I'm now following, that her whole approach, particularly around the cork and oil and linseed oil mix, is to use the modern term ketogenic. I think if she was alive today and she was away, had access as she would have to the internet and publish her stuff and become and get the fame that she would have deserved, she would be sitting right inside that camp with all those people like her who are researching and doing what she did, going against the grain.
Yep, definitely.
It's awesome.
I think one of the particular things we have to be grateful about Johanna Budvig was that she was so single-minded and was prepared to overcome the resistance. In fact, I believe at one stage she was so successful with healing people from multiple diseases, including cancer, far better than conventional treatments.
Yes,
that those in those conventional roles were didn't like what she was doing, so they accused her of practicing medicine without a license.
Yeah.
And instead of giving up and say, okay, you know, I don't want to go to jail, she qualified as a doctor. So so that was, in my mind, was the ultimate two fingers to the authority.
Yes. Yeah,
who just said, okay, I'll go along with that. I'll qualify as a doctor and then I'll carry on.
You can just imagine how much they loved her.
But what incredible passion for what she did, that she was able to resist all these harassment. Yeah. And
but what was ultimately really, in some ways, really sad was that the very people who knocked her and made her life so difficult when their family had cancer or they themselves had cancer, well, guess who they turned to.
No, that was tragic, really.
Really, really unbelievable. Especially the oncologists who would go to her because they weren't going to take their own treatments. You know, that was awesome.
Mm.
But anyway, so Stuttgart and Klaus in particular, because we've all got the connection. He he's a mind store teacher kind of thing. But anyone who's had the privilege of hearing him, and you can hear him, funnily enough, on one of the podcasts on here. He is just one of those guys that you instantly are attracted to. You have a straight sense of trust in him. He's a big guy. He's a big guy, not just physically, but he's a giant of a man as a spirit as well.
And the thing that I love about Klaus and Lothar is that they're not men. They are in business with this clinic, but they are men who are on a mission to help and heal people. They're
absolutely
not there to make themselves multimillionaires.
Yeah.
They have a mission to help people.
Yeah.
And that's such a unique thing to come across.
Yeah, And one of the things I love about it is when Lothar, you know, you sit with Lothar, and the thing is that the medical world, the doctors who are working day in, day out, flat out in that, and they all mean well, of course, we're not knocking them, but they don't have time to look at the latest research and find out what's going on. And obviously, if they do get any research, it's usually backed by Big Pharma. That's where it's coming from. So they don't know about alternatives. They haven't got time. And, of course, they're going to poo-poo them if it's not got the big scientific thing. But the thing is, if you put an oncologist sat right down beside Lothar, Lothar knows more about cancer than they will ever know. And that's really quite interesting too. It's fascinating.
That's really quite scary, isn't it?
It is. But Lothar is an extraordinary man. And what I love about both him and Lothar and the staff there, I'm sure you'll remember the staff are awesome, is that they have this ability to communicate that and communicate it so well. You know, they take what's very complicated and are able to put it into layman's terms or layperson's terms so that we can easily understand it and get behind it.
But also they've created an ethos there that is about positivity and healing.
Yeah, of course.
And it's an environment that is conducive for healing.
Yeah.
As the typical NHS hospital is an environment for illness and death in some cases.
Yes. And when I was there, one of the women I met who was doing a sort of mindfulness type module for them, which was it was good to sit in that, let someone else stand up in the front and teach people to meditate. And she was awesome. And she told us, you know, she said, I've had three times in my life I've been visited by cancer and life-threatening cancer. And she said, and every time it's come along, it's been a wonderful gift. I mean, just what an amazing, amazing woman she was. And the encouragement she gave everybody else who were, you know, in that audience who were facing cancer was just amazing. You know, it's fantastic, actually. But, yeah, it's not always easy for people to hear these conversations. It's very tough. But, you know, these conversations are happening more and more. And I'm grateful for you bringing it up. I really am.
Well, one of the things I find fascinating, having followed your journey for 30 years or so, is that, as you said earlier, you know, there were people that thought you were completely mad. You were sort of some weird cult, and you were trying to brainwash them and do all sort of funny, sort of potentially evil things. And you know, but it's an example of being ahead of your time, because now mindfulness is one of those buzzwords that one of the new fashionable things, and suddenly mindfulness, which is of course sort of what you were doing 30 years ago, when it was completely, you know, hooey and witch doctory and that sort of thing, is now mainstream and very fashionable and very trendy.
And funnily enough, all the left-brain scientists have piled in as well. So there you go. I've always said that we're ahead of them, and I really genuinely believe that. They're just catching up, but that's good. And slowly but surely, they're catching up with the anecdotal stuff that's been going on with this lifestyle, and now the science is proving it's absolutely true. Yeah, the world's moving towards some time where I think we're all going to have to just give them an amnesty, you know, just say, look, enough's enough, we forgive you, you meant well, and you came from the right place with the resources you had, but it's really time now to embrace a new kind of world, and hopefully that's going to happen sooner rather than later.
Well, I totally agree, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, Jonathan, we could go on and on, and I love chatting to you at the best of times, but it's been really good sharing this time with you on the podcast. Thanks for giving us your time. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, John. Jack, it's been a great privilege.
Good man. Excellent. Thanks, Jonathan. Well, all the best with whatever you're up to next in this semi-retirement I think you're really doing. I don't think you're retired at all somehow. And please keep posting those amazing things and those photographs that you do on Facebook, because they're amazing. Really enjoy seeing what you're doing.
Well, thanks very much, Shaka. I'll do that.
Cheers, Jonathan. All the best now. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Jack. Bye.
Thank you.